This is Scott Becker with the Becker Private Equity and Business Podcast. We're visiting today with Matt Wolf. Matt's a leader at RSM. RSM's a leader in the private equity space. Matt talks to us regularly about the economic issues out there and what we're seeing in private equity deal flow and a lot more. Matt, let me tee it up and ask you, what are we seeing in private equity deal flow? What's the temperature out there?
Yeah, it's recovering is a way we characterize it, particularly in the middle market. You know, I think we've talked about it a little bit before, and it's kind of the same. It's been over the last month or so where, you know, there's still volume out there. There's still, you know, private equity needs to put money to work. There are still deals happening. They're just changing shape a little bit. Maybe fewer platform acquisitions, more tuck-in type acquisitions, even putting some money to work in de novo or organic growth, putting that money to work in different ways. But it is recovering. You know, we're not going to probably have another year like 2021 anytime soon, but it's recovering, primarily just because, you know, there's a lot of dry powder that needs to be put to work, right? Depending on how you want to measure it, looking just at healthcare kind of buyout funds, we have almost $200 billion of dry powder in the United States alone. So there's a lot of money sloshing around out there that will continue to drive deal flow.
It's certainly when you get beyond healthcare, that number rises to almost a couple trillion dollars. What do private equity funds do when they're not finding the valuations or the deals that they want? How do they approach that? What do you see out there?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, longer hold periods for sure, which kind of helps with some of the ROI of making specific investments in the platforms themselves. And so we've kind of seen with the change in the credit cycle, there's almost this sort of shift in focus from financial engineering or financial multiple arbitrage as a means to drive returns into really almost more like a growth investment strategy to drive those returns, right? We're not going to hit the 20% cash on cash return we want just by exploiting multiple arbitrage. We're going to have to take some funds and we're going to have to invest maybe in a better ERP tool or a better CRM, like customer relationship management tools, things like that. Maybe invest in automation, things that when your hold period was only maybe 2 years in some cases, it just didn't make sense to make those investments. But now with multiples where they're at, and they'll probably stay here for a while, we're seeing sponsors lengthen their hold periods and make some of those investments in trying to drive improvement and margin in the businesses to position themselves for the sales that they need to generate the returns that they need.
And when you look at multiple arbitrage, for a while that was easy in two different ways. You'd buy tuck-ins at 7 or 8, but the multiples on sale deals were 12. And you also had for 4 or 5 years a rising tide of multiples. Now you've got a decreasing tide of multiples, not higher. And so multiple arbitrage gets harder. So private equity funds have to find value and add value in different ways. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, absolutely. One other point on the multiple arbitrage component, or I guess really just, you know, when we think of multiples, is a multiple is a price like any other, right? And it's driven by factors of supply and demand. And, you know, one thing that we are watching for is sort of this seller expectations of what is an appropriate multiple, not only from say a founder-owned business, right, of what do they think the multiple is worth, or what multiple should they get on a deal when they sell their baby, but also just the PE firms themselves, right? And as more of those sellers come to the realization that, all right, we're not going to be able to get the multiple that existed a year ago, 2 years ago, we're going to have to sell at this lower multiple, we'll see more assets coming to market. We'll see that supply increase, which may have an additional decrease on multiples, but eventually the holdouts will sell.
Well, certainly, and there's plenty of funds that are holding investments far longer than they wanted to that might have lost hope they'll be able to turn them around or turn them into a big returning investment, and at some point they could take their medicine like everybody else, sell those to somebody else, and see if somebody else can figure out what to do with them. But what a fascinating situation. But nobody wants to take their medicine unless all the peer groups are taking their medicine too. Is that a fair assessment? Well,
yes, yes. And one kind of direct knock-on effect of that we've definitely seen, Scott, is the rise of secondary funds. Right. So maybe the sponsor wants to take a little bit of cash off the table. Maybe they don't exit their full position. They're able to sell a portion or sell some minority shares, help kind of adjust the cap table, get some money out, sell to a secondary fund. And then, you know, that can help sort of boost some of those interim returns to help sort of, help. It's like the spoonful of sugar that goes with the medicine of extending that hold period.
And what are you using with secondary funds? Like, I see more and more people forming secondary funds, trying to buy partial interest out of PE sponsored deals. What does that look like? What does some of that look like?
Yeah, it's the data is still kind of collecting, and there's a bit of a lag on some of that, so we don't have great visibility into the total numbers of those secondary funds. But depending on how you want to measure it, maybe 50 to 200% increase in formation of secondary funds, fundraising of secondary funds, as they get really aggressive, because now there's just so much more of an appetite for those sort of investment vehicles. And I think as interest rates remain high, and as we've discussed before, we're unlikely to go back to a 25 basis point Fed funds rate anytime soon, if ever. We'll continue to see a market for these secondary funds.
And Matt, anything else that's top of mind you wanted to share with listeners today?
Yeah, there's another topic, and we continue to watch what's going on in the leveraged loan markets. And over the past few quarters, we've really seen default rates increase on leveraged loans, sort of back to kind of pre-pandemic norms, which makes sense, right, as interest rates increase and things like that. But one effect that we're really watching too, that is probably more short to medium term, is a lot of these loans that were issued during the frenzy of the sort of last few years of deal making were, covenant light loans, and they maybe lacked certain protections that new leverage loans are being issued with. And so what we're seeing is, of those loans that do default, many of them, the recoverability of those notes is not where they were pre-pandemic. Pre-pandemic, kind of a rule of thumb was maybe get 2/3 to 75% back during a typical sort of bankruptcy default proceeding of a leveraged loan, possibly, right? Some much more, some much less. But now we're starting to see a lot of proceedings where, some of these BDC sponsors, investors we talked to are saying, yeah, we're looking to get maybe 15% back, maybe 20% back. And so that's something that we're watching too, especially as we see these leveraged loan default rates increase, is, okay, what's going on with recoverability? How recoverable are these loans? And then as these lenders get burned on some of these deals that they agreed to during the pandemic, does that mean that going forward, these lending covenants, these restrictions and the loan agreements are going to get even tighter, right, going forward? So what we're watching what the effect of that will be too.
And what does that mean? One of the hottest asset classes the last several years, it continued to grow, is this private debt, private credit world. When you see these restructurings, some of these things go south, what does that mean for that world? And does that just remain so hot because yields are so high in it? Or is there enough default risk that that's going to soften some? What do you see there?
Yeah, I think it will soften some, right? I mean, the flows of money through the markets, right? Whether it's private equity, private debt, public equities, ETFs, like these flows kind of work. They have inertia to them, right? So right now, as you said, private credit is very hot. Especially as LPs want to put money into private markets. Some we've heard and seen from surveys and other data are preferring private credit to private equity, and so they're, like you said, private credit really is experience this sort of boom of interest. And like any other boom of interest or other sort of cycle, there's likely to overshoot wherever that equilibrium is in terms of money flowing into private credit. It just remains to be seen how badly we'll overshoot it.
Thank you very much. It really is fascinating how an asset class gets hot. So much money flows towards it. They're sitting on so much money to invest, but they invest behind private equity sponsored deals. Then all of a sudden you see some restructuring of those debts and deals, and that creates sort of another climate in terms of what that looks like, in terms of what felt like a very safe asset. All of a sudden you've got enough, make enough money on yield to make up with for whatever percentage of bankruptcies are going to be out there. But it's really a fascinating cyclical thing. Matt, as always, I want to thank you for joining us on the Becker Private Equity Business Podcast. I always learn something, and I really appreciate you bringing up the issue on restructuring and how challenging some of that looks on some of these debts. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.